Inhabitants of pinch trees.
This is Judge Dredd.
In case you people have forgotten, Mama is not the law.
I am the law.
Borag Thong creeps, and welcome to another episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Now, I'm sure you all recognise the dulcet tones of Carl Urban in the Dread movie from 2012 at the beginning of this episode. That's because we're going to be talking to Arthur Wyatt, who is the writer on the Dread movie tie-in sequel comic, which this month is coming out in US format, so it'll be available on both sides of the Atlantic, and that is Dread Dust, with art by Ben Wilshire, which we're very much looking forward to reading. We're also going to be talking to John Repian, Leah Moore and Tom Foster about Storm Warning, which is one of the stories that appears in Britsit Noir, the latest graphic novel from 2000 AD, which is out this week. Before we get to the interviews, it would be remiss of me not to let you know about what 2000 AD has coming out this week. Prog 1975 continues the stories from our Jumping On issue a couple of weeks ago. If you've not picked up the Jumping On issue, Prog 1973, then I really do recommend you do so. Five fantastic stories by our top creators and the perfect Jumping On issue if you are a new or lapsed reader. If you're just curious about 2000 AD, now's the time to jump on board as we head towards our 40th anniversary with some Zarjazz thrills. As I mentioned, Britsit Noir is out in paperback this week from all good UK stockists, as well as digitally on the 2000 AD web shop and apps. That's the Apple app, that's the Android app, and also the new Windows 10 app. Joining it as well is Sooner or Later. Now, those of you who particularly like things like Tank Girl will enjoy Sooner or Later because Jamie Hewlett was one of the creators on this madcap time travel story from the 1980s, which ran on the back page of 2000 AD for some time. This is the first time the entire story has been collected together with script by Peter Milligan, who you'll know from Bad Company for 2000 AD, but also series such as Ecstatics and Shade the Changing Man for DC, and also Brendan McCarthy, who we interviewed on the Thrillcast a number of episodes ago about his work co-writing and doing the storyboarding and concept work for Mad Max Fury Road. Sooner or Later is a fantastic time capsule of a story really embedded in the 80s, got an amazing sense of time and place, and also is just an awful lot of fun. You can pick that up in print and digital now. So let's talk about Britsit Noir, which is out this week in paperback. This contains two stories, Storm Warning by Leah Moore, John Repian and Tom Foster, and also Strange and Dark by John Smith and Colin McNeil. Now, this is a collection that takes place in Britsit, which is the Britain of Judge Dredd's world, and concerns itself with the weird and wonderful. We've got two side division judges who investigate some strange goings on, one in Wales and one in the north of England. And to talk about Storm Warning, I'm very pleased to welcome Leah Moore and John Repian to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, hello.
So we're talking about Britsit Noir, which is out this week. Storm Warning is a story that I was very excited about, really enjoyed reading, because it is exploring the kind of hauntedness of the British Isles. Do you guys want to just explain a little bit about the genesis of Storm Warning?
Basically, we were asked. Matt said, "Did we want to do something? Do a story? We'd done Black Shuck, which was our like history one, but we wanted to do
something historical." Is stretching it a bit with
historical werewolves.
Yeah, we set in some version of the past,
right?
But we just wanted to do some sort of bit of the megaverse, and obviously we like to do stuff that's like in our own kind of weird eldritch part of the megaverse, I guess. So yeah, Britsit was attractive for that
sure,
reason, definitely.
Sure. We
obviously doing something to do with side division was our first choice because we want to keep the weirdness in there, keep the kind of the bit of a horror vibe in there and a bit of a sticking some of the folklore-y stuff in there that we always love to do. So it was just sort of a natural choice to try and crowbar all that stuff into one.
And in terms of the way the series panned out, what were the themes that you were going for this? Because obviously there's so much to play with in the JoJo Day world. What were you specifically going for? Was it that kind of old school horror vibe that you were looking for?
Yeah, I think old school British horror, basically, because I think that the sort of the pleasure of Britsit, I think, for all the creators that write it, is that you get to kind of play with real life kind of British kind of tropes and ideas and jokes and kind of that kind of stuff. But I think that there's like a really big sort of there's a rich history of British sort of oddness. Like the other day, like Quatermass and the Pit just popped up on the planner as I was looking on the television. I was just like, there's loads of M.R. James and all these kind of things that you as a British person you just take for granted, that there's all these this fantastic kind of spooky alternative kind of history going on. But I think that it's wonderful to kind of because I think there's sort of the all the mega cities and stuff, there's a lot of richness there, but I love the idea that with Psy Division you get to actually go that there's this whole kind of ghosty kind of background to it, and it gave us an excuse to kind of wallow about in some of our fanboy stuff,
and to put all our nods and winks into things like Quatermass and M.R. James, and just to tip our hat at all that stuff. And
sure,
it's that sort of to me, it always feels kind of, 2000 AD isn't a retro thing in any way, but there's kind of there's a 70s, 80s vibe about some bits of it still. And that is sort of the, I think that's the thing that we wanted to get into some of the Britsit stuff, was kind of coming back to. I was rewatching Life Force again the other night, and it's all that kind of stuff. Where
he watches it every night.
I watch it every night. But when you get this kind of the horror and the sci-fi and the Britishness and the sort of one of the most fun aspects of the very British part of all that is everybody's reactions to stuff. Is having all these people in these weird situations and having them be understated and, having them react to these things in a very British, have a cup of tea sort of way. So it was nice to be able to do a bit of that as well.
Sure, sure. Talking about influences, I watched The Stone Tapes.
Yes.
For the first time a little while ago. And Lillian Storm, who is the protagonist in Storm Warning, has the ability to communicate with the dead through objects. And all of a sudden it all kind of came rushing back, this kind of very, as you say, kind of Quatermassy 1970s old school TV drama kind of vibe to the whole thing. Tell us a little bit about Lillian Storm as a character, because certainly in terms of female judges who appeared in 2000 AD, they tend to either be your kind of Judge Hershey's, so kicking ass on the streets, or your Judge Andersons, who are a bit more sensitive, a bit more involved in the supernatural kind of thing. Tell us a bit about where Lillian fits and how she came to be.
I think women are quite often given the part, like in they're always given in sci-fi, they're like the empath, or they're kind of like they have feelings, so they just have like super feelings, and we really didn't want her to just be kind of somebody who ran about being emotionally affected by paranormal stuff. Basically, she's kind of had this incredibly weird, intense kind of paranormal trauma as a kid, and it's had this profound effect on her, which has given her like abilities, but it hasn't meant that she's kind of this super enlightened kind of, she's basically as messed up and weird and antisocial as you might be after, you know, after having like a weird kind of life. So one of the part of the thing we've really enjoyed writing her is that she's difficult to be around. She's difficult to talk to. People, like men and women, find her quite kind of tough to get along with. And she's an odd character. And it's so, I mean, it's nice to write any character that's, because I think with writing, you sometimes find yourself using your characters to just kind of fill out your plot and explain things and relate to each other. And you kind of, sometimes you forget that you're allowed to just make them be awkward, horrible, stubborn, you know, weird people. And it's particularly nice to be able to write a woman as that, because women are quite often written. I mean, in our stuff, you would go like, oh, I want to do someone who's a good role model,
you try and make people nice or relatable or
badass. She's not taking any shit from it, you know. So you have that kind of idea, I think. And I think that quite a lot of female lead characters kind of fall into either the kind of cheerful empath or the I'm not taking this, I'm gonna, you know, be taking names and everything. So but I think she's a real treasure to write because of not being those.
Being an awkward weirdo.
Yeah.
But we, I mean,
paranormal.
Saying about the empath thing, there's a thing running through this story where she says to people a few different times, I don't do touching. And we put that in because I think a lot of readers expect that to be that, if anybody does touch her, like Leah said, there's going to be a whole thing where she goes, oh, all of your pain and your emotions and your past experience, this is, you know, it's overwhelming to me. And that isn't what happens if you touch her. It's sort of quite the opposite of that. So there's stuff like that where we manage to possibly invert some of the things that you would expect from a female judge who was in touch with kind of the spirit world and, make it a little bit more grim and gritty.
Brexit is a part of Judge Dredd's world that hasn't really been explored in real depth. I mean, we've had series like Armitage, Brexit Brute, things like that, but it's rarely moved outside of the kind of southeast area. Does that give you as writers an extraordinary chance to flesh out this world?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and obviously, with the book, with Brexit Noir, then it's we're being paired up with John Smith's Strange and Dark, and that is, you know, we're operating in very much the same sphere as that. They join up quite nicely, and it's playing with the rest of England as much of it as is left. And yeah, you know, there's some brilliant stuff in that Strange and Dark where that's all set in Wales or what's left of Wales. And so it's the same sort of thing. We get to send people up north, as far north as they can go, and see what it's like up there. So there's plenty of room to play around and to flesh stuff out. So that was loads of fun. Yeah, having sort of certain parameters, but having free reign within those parameters.
And Tom is a newcomer to 2000 AD. He'd only done I think one, maybe two strips, short strips for us, whereas this was a multi-part series with by 2000 AD standards over double length episodes. Were you conscious of that while you were writing the script? Did you make sure that you were playing to his strengths?
We really didn't, right from the start, we didn't really know exactly how he was going to respond to it. And we were just kind of, we're really used to just like, you know, we're used to writing months and months ahead of our artists, because for American publishers, we quite often end up, they go, oh, we'd like to get the script in, and then we're sorting out the artist. And so we're used to kind of just writing script fairly kind of blankly, not really knowing what's going to happen. But I have to say, when we got Tom's work back in, it was fascinating to see his process and fascinating to see the weird atmosphere over the course of the of each like episode. It's got a really unique flavor, and I absolutely love the way he draws Storm. I love the way that he's put so much personality into her, and I particularly loved he was sharing some sketches and stuff on Twitter, I think, and somebody said, "Oh, you know, is that a man or a woman? You know, I can't tell from that drawing." And he said, "It's a judge," and I was just like, "Yeah, mic drop, fantastic!" But I think he's, you know, I was when we were up at Thought Bubble in November. Then it was lovely to go through his portfolio and actually see the inky pages up close and see his, because his technique is phenomenal. So we're absolutely overjoyed to have him on the strip.
You know, he wasn't afraid to have a bit of back and forth with us, which is always good. You know, that's really the best you can hope for when you're working with an artist, whether it's a new artist or somebody who's, you know, an old hand. If they're willing to talk to you about what they're doing and discuss why they might be doing something different to what you've said, what might work better, that's much better than somebody just handing pages back that are completely different to what you've given them and not explaining why. You know, always happy for anybody to change the layouts on stuff as long as there's a reason for it. People, you know, they're as much part of the storytelling as we are, obviously. I mean, they're more so in terms of what people are seeing. You know, when we're working with Stevie Ole, then not until this next series that we've been writing with him, then I haven't realised to not bother laying the pages out for him. Like, we know what our page looks like in our head, but he's going to do his thing with it. So you tell him how many panels there are and you tell him what's happening in the panels. You don't bother to say panel sizes. Mm. And it's different working with different artists. And, you know, Tom was brilliant with the layouts. He was really, really tight with lots of stuff. And then when he wasn't, there was a reason why he wasn't. And as long as there's some dialogue between the writer and the artist, that's brilliant. You know, that's what you want.
It was always for the best as well. He would never just sort of mess about with the layout to do like a sort of, you know, a wacky layout or, you know, something that, or just, you know, to show off one panel or, not that I'm saying anybody we've ever worked with has done that, but, you know, I can imagine that if you were drawing something and you go, do you know what, I really don't want to draw that enormous, like, infinite library panel, I'll just make it kind of small. You know, I would do those things. I know there's no way I'd draw it. So,
oh, yeah, well, we gave Tom some horrible staircase stuff to do inside a big,
yeah, a just big, like a big awful block. Perspective.
So, and he did all that brilliantly. So.
He put in beats of like little scenes. He'd put in a couple of beats and say, oh, I thought that would give this character a bit more time to, you know, they'd be like pausing to reflect on that and then they'd decide on this. And it was just kind of showing not only was he interested in the story, but he's properly engaged with the characters and really into like making the world and making that person. And to be honest, you know, you can't buy that kind of collaboration. That's fantastic. So, yeah. Thank you, Tom.
And are there any more plans for further adventures of Lillian Storm?
We would absolutely love to. We would, you know, these, like you say, it's the whole of, you know, the you know, British Isles of Wight is totally unexplored. So if we could, we'd happily have Lillian wandering about, being irascible and unpleasant in any number of places. That would be.
I'm sure quite a few of our listeners are huge fans of Judge Dredd. We tend to find that a lot of our readers skew towards Judge Dredd, so that's the thing that they enjoy reading. To someone who reads Dredd but hasn't necessarily branched out to the Dredd world stuff, what would you say to them to encourage to pick up a collection like Britsit Noir, which, as you say, has John Smith and Colin O'Neill on Strange and Dark, and yourselves and Tom on Storm Warning?
I suppose it's just coming at everything from a different angle. So it's like, if you do enjoy Judge Dredd, if you enjoy all the Mega City stuff, it's a chance to get a slice of something similar but of a slightly different flavour, if you like.
Yeah, no, I think it's the sense of humour as well, because the thing about Dredd and the whole kind of where the origins of it are is that it's a satire. It's a hilarious look at this kind of like hideous extreme society with all this. So, but the humour behind it, it's the one-liners and it's the kind of the actual it's the joyfulness that it's delivered with. And I think that the kind of the more like Anglophile type kind of, I think the British it basically, it does all of that, but it does it with the kind of a really unique, odd British sort of
sensibility
on it. So I guess it's kind of, it's making, if the Dreadverse is already like is a satire, then it's like, okay, if you take this enormous inflated sort of satirical kind of look and then bring it down to kind of carpet slippers and cups of tea, and it's kind of how would we go about it in a sort of slightly weary, slightly drab kind of way?
It's like Dalton and Simpsons, Judge Dredd.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, or like, yeah, or Wallace and Gromit, that kind of, yeah, everything you get, it's a bit scuffed. So, yeah, but, yes, we are Judge Dredd, well, but scuffed. Yeah. Dusty. Is that selling it?
That's spot on. Couldn't have done a better job myself. So we've talked to the writers of Storm Warning, so let's talk about the art. Tom Foster is a newcomer to 2000 AD, having found fame and fortune as a winner of the Thought Bubble portfolio contest a couple of years ago. This is his first multi-part series for 2000 AD, and it's a pleasure to welcome to the podcast. Hiya, Tom.
Hello, yes, thank you. it's lovely to be back.
So we're talking about Britsit Noir. This was your first multi-part series for 2000 AD.
Was it, as
somebody who'd only just started work for us, we found you through the 2000 AD portfolio competition at the Thought Bubble convention a couple of years ago. Was it pretty daunting going into a series such as this?
Yes, it was. Mostly because I was still kind of finding my kind of process, if you like.
Yeah.
I hadn't really settled on a kind of day-to-day way of doing things. I mean, regarding the work itself, but also, you know, just how I arranged everything else around work. So I ended up making a lot of very interesting discoveries along the way, which informed how I would go on to do things. But also, I mean, obviously, because I was fairly untested, having only done four pages before for a one-shot story, there was no real sense going into the series of what might be an assignment that would suit my process, my speed, or everything, because it hadn't been established yet. So from both ends, there was a kind of, you know, it was a bit of a litmus test to see how I would work with material and you know, what it would look like and how long it would take and how I would go about it and all those things. So now, with things that I've sort of been working on since, there's far more of a sense of it being coordinated in a way which works for me and for Tharg. But at the time, it was a bit of just a kind of stramash to see if I could do this. And I hope it will be considered that I was partially successful in that task. Yes, it was daunting, but mostly just because so much of the way that I would go on to do things had not yet been established.
Sure, sure. In terms of the page count, I mean, this wasn't a series that appeared in 2000 AD, so it's not 4 or 5 pages a week. This is more than double the length of that every month. What did you find? Did you find that your style, as you made your discoveries, that your style changed, or were you fighting to maintain a certain consistency in what you were doing as you were doing these big sort of 10-page episodes of a multi-part story?
The style did change to some extent, but a lot of that was because, sort of for two reasons. One, because I think with any kind of comic book artist, their first year or whatever, doing it as a full-time job, as opposed to, you know, doing bits and pieces here and there to try and get work, your style or the quality of your art changes as much in that 1 year as it would in maybe five, without having that kind of regular work. So there was that. There was the fact that I was sort of evolving as I went, but also when I started this, I made the kind of, I don't know if it was, it ended up being the right decision, but I made a kind of risky decision of going about things a completely different way in terms of how I constructed pages and what tools I used and everything. I was using mostly just kind of photo reference before I got this series. And then when I got the series, I just started experimenting with using 3D models and environments as a basis for my pages before I went into the penciling and the inking stages. So there was a sort of a bit of a kind of teething period using that where it didn't look 100% satisfying. It sort of looked like it looked too, the software was too kind of evident in the end result. I hadn't learned how to kind of compensate for the quirks of doing things with computers. But by the end of it, I'd sort of nailed down, I think, pretty much how I would go about it and streamlined it a little bit. I guess my process did change. And I wouldn't necessarily say I got faster, but I got more consistent speed.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about influences and the style that you bring to Storm Warning, the series that you did in Britsit Noir. There's obvious ones like Brian Bolland, but I also detect elements of sort of more classic comic book artists from the 70s and 80s, all of which kind of come together in the perfect style for horror, which is, you know, the supernatural horror is what Britsit Noir is all about. Who were you channeling when you were drawing Storm Warning?
I'm trying to be careful here not to sound sort of sacrilegious in terms of, if I say I was channeling someone, that may sound like I think I'm capable of emulating them. But I guess the people who were most kind of at the forefront of my mind when I was doing it. Obviously, Brian Bolland's kind of the big one with that's just, he's the kind of mast to which I've nailed my colours. I guess Mike Tiedato Jr. is kind of was a big one because he was the first guy that I'd really seen use the type of software that I was using successfully and create very dramatic looking black and white work. So he was a big influence. So he's more, that's more contemporary, obviously. I guess people like Bernie Wrightson, there was a little bit of Alex Toth in there but that sort of turned up accidentally. Like I would know I'd gotten a panel composition right if I thought, that reminds me of the way that Alex Toth might have laid out a panel. Even people like John Romita Sr., like he was always a big influence on me and Mark Bagley and stuff because of the cleanliness of their work, like in terms of it always looked very finished, which is not something you would normally associate with horror. Comics. Normally, you would think of them as having a kind of a more of a rugged style.
Sure.
People like Sean Gordon Murphy and Zapfino. I can't remember which of the Zapfinos is the senior one who did Winterworld. But they were people that I'd kind of tried to emulate previously when I'd done submissions scripts and things, like previous years of portfolio competition and stuff, I tried to kind of take them on board as influences, but I realized that there's only so much you can kind of assimilate a style into your own without kind of... Some styles are just kind of incompatible with each other to a certain extent. Mm. But I learned a fair amount from doing it, but I did discover that that's not really the way I go about things. I try and make things as kind of finished and kind of solid and delineated as possible, and maybe save the ruggedness for backgrounds, which is something that I'm only just sort of starting to do now, but seems to work pretty well. Mm. So those, I guess those are the people I was most thinking of.
Okay.
Oh, and Al Williamson as well.
And in terms of the supernatural horror elements of Storm Warning, did you enjoy creating this real sense of atmosphere? Because there's so many shadows and horrors. There's a wonderful moment early on in the strip where one of the characters turns their flashlight onto a wall in which somebody has become embedded in the kind of, you know, at a molecular level. And just the interplay of light and dark of the flashlight and the shadow. That was a really nice kind of, for me, harking back to an almost EC Comics style of horror. It seemed like you were having a bit of fun.
I was, although it was kind of a process of experimentation as well. Mm. I really wanted, because those initial pages were all lit by torchlight. I that was something that I was kind of unfamiliar with. I wasn't used to having to do kind of complex lighting and things with environments and stuff. But because I had this new tool at my disposal in the form of the 3D software, which allows you to light stuff and experiment stuff, I spent a lot of time playing around with shadows and things and experimenting to see where I could cast shadows that would be dramatic but also create a good composition. I did lose a lot of time early on with trying to achieve that just through manipulation of 3D stuff. Whereas now, like, I tend not to focus so much on the shadows and things, and just use the 3D model as a kind of very rough foundation.
Mm.
But it was a really great. Sometimes when you're struggling with a new approach, and you've got a sort of a scene which gives you the perfect opportunity to experiment with it as much as possible, then you do get nice little things that come out of it that you wouldn't have otherwise got, and I guess that's what happened this time.
Mm.
Looking back at particularly that first issue, the stuff with the shadows and things like you say, like that panel with the person embedded in the wall and stuff, that's the stuff I like the most, because it sort of justifies the kind of infancy of the process that I was going through. It kind of makes me go, okay, well, it's not exactly how I would do things now, but I don't mind because something good came out of it.
Mm, mm. And what was it like working with John and Leah, who although they are relatively new to 2000 AD, they do have quite a few comics under their belt?
Oh, it was great. They were very kind of... I think they liked the fact that I was kind of invested in it and I would email them every so often and try not to sort of saturate them with emails, but get some sense of, like, if I wanted to do something slightly differently from the way it was in the script, I would just email them and say, look, here's... Or if I had a question about the way that the... about the way some action took place or whatever, I would ask them about it, but try and do it in a way where, you know, really think about things first and only ask them as kind of intelligent questions as I could manage. Like, for example, in that first issue, there's the scene where there's a big column of light, and the kind of necromancer type fellow summons these big weird monsters to attack the judges, and they're dispatched with these exorcist bullets. And in the obviously, when you're reading a script, it just says that the creatures that shoots the creatures, so they're dead now. And then it just goes on to explain the rest of the action, but it didn't mention whether or not these creatures were corporeal, and therefore their giant bodies would still be lying around the chamber or basement where the rest of the action took place, which would of course dictate the look of all the rest of the panel. Now, I'm not saying obviously that wasn't a mistake on the part of the writers, because they knew that these creatures were just sort of ethereal and would disappear as soon as they were shot. But it was something I wasn't clear about. But it is funny how one little thing like that, one kind of thing that isn't mentioned, can make a huge difference to how the rest of the page would play out. Mm. But they were very kind of open to me asking things like that and putting me right. So it was great. And they were very encouraging and never really, were put out if I was being a bit of a diva and trying to do things my own way or whatever.
And now that Blitzit Noir is being collected with Storm Warning in it, what's it like as a new artist to have done a series like this and relatively quickly see it appear in a nice paperback edition?
It's great. I was surprised that it had gone to paperback so quickly, to be honest. I thought, maybe one day it might feature in a collection or something, but I didn't know when or if that would be. There's so much work, particularly with an anthology title like 2000 AD or the Judge Dredd magazine. There's so much to potentially put in a trade that it was something that I didn't really give any thought to. But it's hugely flattering. I've not seen it yet, the print version. I'm really looking forward to that. I think some of my kind of development work and things is maybe in there as well. Not having seen it, I don't want to kind of say that too definitively, because I'm not sure. But I think some of my kind of black and white stuff is in there, which would be great, because I'm a big sort of inks person, so I do like to get that stuff out there as well. But I guess it's going to be good to. I used to work in a bookshop, so it's going to be nice to be able to go in and just sort of saunter in and be like, oh, that, there's mine. Oh, excuse me, do you have Blitzit Noir?
Do you have Fly Fishing by J.R.R. Hartley?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Can you keep it for me? That would be a nice experience to not to lord it over the people, because I offend there. People might be listening to this. I got on great with a lot of the people there. But just to be able to go into a place where I formerly worked as a retail environment and have a product there.
Yeah.
Maybe have a little signed by the author sticker. make its way onto the page.
Whether they like it or not.
Yeah. So in other words, it's a massive boost to my ego, and that's what's important. That answers the question.
Brilliant. So thanks again to Tom, Leah and John for talking to us. Now, don't forget that we need your questions. Ask Tharg is a surprisingly popular part of the podcast, where Tharg the Mighty, the alien editor of 2000 AD, answers your questions about the galaxy's greatest comic. So make sure that if you have a burning question for Tharg the Mighty, that you send it on to us by emailing thrillcast@2000adonline.com. That's thrillcast@2000adonline.com. 2000online.com, or you can tweet us your questions. We're on Twitter at 2000AD.
Citizens of Peachtrees, this is the law. Who think you are coming up here? Disperse immediately, or we will use lethal force to clear the area.
Where's that coming from?
Over there. Access corridor.
You have been warned. You now have 20 seconds to comply.
So it was the cult hit movie of 2012, starring Carl Urban and Olivia Thirlby, with a fantastic script by Alex Garland. Didn't spawn a sequel, so sorry about that, Earthlets. We'd love that to happen, but the story did not end there. It continued in the pages of the Judge Dredd magazine and in US format series with Dredd Underbelly, Uprise, and coming soon this month, Dust, written by Arthur Wyatt with art by Ben Wilshire. This is the latest comic book sequel tie-in, which explores this amazing world that was such an integral part of the movie. And all the way from Seattle, I'm very pleased to welcome Arthur Wyatt, the writer on the series, as we prepare to delve into Dredd Dust. Welcome, Arthur.
Hi.
thanks so much for joining us. This is the third Dredd movie sequel comic book tie-in series. That's a bit of a mouthful. Let's talk a bit about how you came to be writing the movie tie-in series, because you started off with Underbelly, didn't you?
Uh-huh. And Underbelly at the time, I really thought that was a one-off. That was actually something that Matt Smith, or Farg, requested I do. I was really, really excited to get that request, because I was big fan of the movie. And I thought it was a world that had a lot of potential. So at that time, even though there was only really the one-off series that I was doing, I did put together a little email where I sort of infused quite wildly about the possibility of the Dredd movie world as being sort of almost like a sort of a Marvel Ultimate version of the Dredd universe, where we could take a sort of slightly different take on the universe and expand upon it. And I don't know if that really influenced things and led to me doing more, or if they just sort of happened to be a natural seller. I know that it did quite well, or at least it sold more than they initially printed. So that's always a good sign.
Well, it was one of our first US format series. In terms of the tone of the thing, obviously, Dredd the movie is different, very different tonally to the comic book Judge Dredd. As someone who has read Judge Dredd for a very long time, how did you, as a writer, balance those two perceptions of the character? Because you know, you've got Judge Dredd in the comic, which is known for a lot of satire, dark humor, violence, extreme environments, but then you have the movie, which played these down quite significantly, while not excluding them completely. How as a writer do you get the level between those two right?
I mean, it's kind of interesting, because the movie, I think, takes a good stab at those. It comes with certain limitations of sort of budget and time and what's achievable when you're sort of introducing the whole thing to the audience in one go. But I think Alex Garland really sort of put forward a Dredd that was a Dredd. There wasn't a sort of a mangling of the concept there. So I think with the comics, there's an odd translation where you sort of take whatever limitations that Dredd came along with and kind of imagine them into the comics page.
Okay.
Which is probably the opposite direction you're going when you're making a movie, where you're trying to give as much as possible.
Mm.
That's like the comic. I'm sort of going the opposite way there slightly, which I think it's a set of constraints that I think gives some interesting results.
Mm. When you first came down to sit down and write Underbelly, did you have a specific direction in mind? Was there a very specific story you wanted to tell in this environment?
My initial thoughts were, we've just had the events of the movie. What can we do that sort of follows on immediately from that and sort of deals with the aftermath of it? And of course, the movie has the downfall of Mama and this drug empire collapsing. So I sort of pretty much naturally drifted towards there being sort of gang war in the wake of that and a sort of new drug emerging, which ended up being the spine of Underbelly. And then I wanted to get a little bit more of the cursed earth into it than the movie actually had, which, you know, within 30 pages wasn't actually all that. But I at least sort of implied that there were people out there coming in and sort of brought in the aspect of the human traffickers bringing people across the wall and exploiting them.
And the character of Dredd in the comic books, in contrast to the movie, there's not that much difference, but there are subtle little differences between the two. Did you find it easy? Did you find it hard to nail Garland's dialogue from the movie?
I mean, I haven't written that much of regular Dredd, and the rule I'm finding apply there kind of applies equally to the movie Dredd, which is you take whatever you write in your first go and you just halve it. You just remove anything that's not necessary for him to say, because he's very, very terse.
Mm.
Also, movie Dredd is, I'd say he's a little bit meaner and less sympathetic than the comic book Dredd is these days. He doesn't have the same,
right,
the same occasional introspective moments.
Mm.
He's more sort of like Dredd 79.
Dust, which is the comic that's going to be coming out in US format this month in April. This is your third story, so you've had a chance to really get under the skin of this different version of Dredd. Tell us a bit about the story and what direction you're taking this different vision of Dredd in.
So my initial sort of idea that I sort of pitched for it was, it actually came from an account I'd read of dust storms in the 1930s.
Mm.
So in America in the 1930s, the topsoil here just got totally depleted. There was like a sort of massive environmental collapse due to overfarming, and you got these incredible storms that would just rip up what was left there in the ground, rip up all the dirt, and just become these immense towering storms that rolled across the middle of the country and were devastating to anyone in their way.
Mm.
I was sort of reading about this and I was thinking, well, we could definitely do one with one of those coming in from the cursed earth. So that ended up being a sort of a major element that you'll see a couple of times in the story, this sort of big environmental menace that they've got to get through.
Mm.
I think also Uprise was a very sort of very city-based story. It was very much sort of about city politics and riots. And I wanted to do something that was sort of the opposite of that. And so getting the action finally out into the cursed earth rather than just showing a little corner of it was a goal.
And Judge Anderson, who was such a major part in the film, has only really been in the comic book sequel a little bit at the very beginning. Was it tempting to always have them team up because that's kind of what people expect from the movie?
I think one of the set of guidelines I received initially was basically don't always have them team up. So we've been very cautious about using Anderson. I don't know if at some point we'll have like a complete blowout Judge Anderson only story, but at the moment, Judge Conte, who's sort of the partner of Dredd in Uprise and Dust, is almost filling in that role. She's sort of a newer judge. There's a bit which I really enjoyed writing in Dust, where she sort of ends up going out to the cursed earth for the first time and seeing this sort of vast expanse of nothingness with no walls and no buildings and no end to it is really mind blowing to her. Which I think it would be if you're just sort of raised in a sort of grey tower block environment the whole of your life.
The art on Underbelly was Henry Flint, and he's really kind of set the tone for the way that the comic book sequel looks, because it's not just a simple fact of transposing what we've seen on screen. How instrumental was Henry in doing that, in setting that early tone, so that you as a writer knew the kind of environment that you were exploring together?
So I actually had a 10-page story that he'd done with Matt Smith before the movie came out, which gave me a pretty good idea of how he'd draw the city. He actually went quite a bit beyond that because, as I understand it, he'd not actually seen the movie before that strip came out. And you'll notice some little elements that have come in from the movie in Underbelly that weren't in the 10 pager. So I don't think he had a reference shot of the judge armor from the back. So in Underbelly, you'll notice they all have the sort of back carapace thing, the armor there, where in the 10 pager they don't. And he does a really couple of really lovely shots of the city that are sort of more influenced by the look of the city in the film than the first set are. I mean, it's definitely a very Henry Flint look to the city, and I think the two artists that followed have sort of very much followed in his steps. At the same time, I think it's a very distinctive look that the movie gives you. So there's a double page spread in Dust where Ben has drawn basically the storm rolling in over the city and clouds of dust sort of passing between these immense tower blocks. And I think that looks very much like something that could come right out of the movie. That's
Alex Garland is one of the editorializing here a little bit, but one of the best screenwriters that's working in kind of action and sci-fi movies at the moment. Were you intimidated by what he'd done with Dredd, or did it just open up lots of possibilities about what you could do with the comic book sequel?
Well, I actually had I was lucky because they published the script, so I was able to read that a couple of times.
Yeah,
and it's a very tight script,
right?
And I know that these published versions of scripts, they often sort of differ slightly from the sort of the final shooting version, which is often a work in progress, and it's sort of a more polished version, but still you just sort of flick through this and there's not much left that's fat on it, which is a bit challenging because if you're writing a sequel to the thing, Dredd basically wraps up the case with Mama. Everyone that Dredd has met that's not Anderson or the chief judge is mostly dead. It's very self-contained. So it became more on what I was hoping is there were the sort of elements I could take from that and build a sort of a more literal sequel, but it really became more sort of like taking the theme and the tone and the style from it.
And you actually had the opportunity to meet Carl Urban at Emerald City Comic Con a little while ago and share a stage with him at a Q&A before a screening of the film. What was that like?
That was slightly intimidating. Mm-hmm. I definitely, when you put me on stage next to a movie star, I definitely seem like a sort of dumpy little potato.
now, how dare you?
That was fun. So I was actually sat between Cole Urban and Jock, who worked on the movie. They certainly had a lot of sort of fun movie anecdotes and facts. I basically had a comic, and at the time it had sold out. So I basically had sort of like a couple of lines of, here's this comic I wrote, you can't get it. It's now available digitally, iTunes, in print.
And in terms of the watching the movie originally, what were your thoughts? I mean, did you ever think that when you were watching it that you would be the person who would be continuing this story?
I really had no thought of that whatsoever. I was just enjoying it purely as a fan. And I watched it. I watched it kind of late. I didn't rush out and see it on the initial run because I had kid commitments. Mm. So I saw it a bit later with some friends as it was nearing the end of its run. And it was great. I got to sit there, and every time something came up on screen that I felt was done right, I got all excited about it. And what was great is the people with me, they didn't really know Dredd much at all, and they were getting excited for it too. So whatever was happening there was really, really working for them and the audience. And then the bit that I really liked the best is it got to the end, and then there in big letters was John Wagner and Carlos Esquerra, and it's like, yes! And screw you, Stallone version. And then the credits just sort of rolled on, and every so often I'd see, oh yeah, all the staff at Rebellion. Well, I know those guys, the fans. Hey, I know those guys. 2000 AD board, yeah.
Now, sort of looking ahead, Dust is coming out this month in US format, so people on both sides of the Atlantic will be able to read it for themselves. Looking beyond Dust, is there a story you'd love to be able to tell in the movie universe?
There's a couple. I'm sort of working on a pitch at the moment, so I'll not talk about that one. there's a couple of obvious ones that we've been staying away from a little when the prospect of the sequel looked a little more likely. I might push. Might push on some of them. I mean, I think we've done that a little by doing a big Cursed Earth story, which was a little bit the presumed sequel at one point, and so we stayed away from it, and now a little less so. So yeah, there's some things that Alex Garland has mentioned we might try and bring into a sequel. There's a whole world of Dredd stories we could sort of try doing, not movie versions of, because I don't like to do a direct take on them, but it's nice doing a little sort of parallel of them. So in a way, Uprise was my take on The Pit. Dust really isn't a take on on Cursed Earth, but it's sort of a take on Cursed Earth stories in general.
There's the obvious one that a lot of people ask about, which is the Dark Judges. Can you see the Dark Judges working in this kind of stripped down, more kind of gritty version of Dredd's world?
I've been thinking about how to do that a lot, and I think I have a way, but I am not telling anyone just yet.
Well, we'll look forward to that, possibly in the future. And that is all we've got time for. Earthlets, thank you so much for joining us on another Zarjazz edition of the 2008 Thrillcast. I'd like to thank once again Arthur, Tom, Leah and John. I'd like to thank all of you for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who's left feedback on iTunes, who's left feedback on SoundCloud, who's tweeted us and Facebooked us and, been really nice about what we're doing. We've got some fantastic interviews coming up over the next few weeks, so make sure you stay tuned for another fortnightly episode of the 2080 Thrillcast. Splundig, Ver, Thrig, Earthlets. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2080 is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2080 is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2080online.com, or you can download the free 2080 app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2080 classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. Splundig ver Thrig, Earthlets.